Jeremy, I was just going to ask you if you could come into my office, please. And I think I'm having some issues here. It's good to see everyone. At this time, I would like to call the meeting to order, and we will begin with a roll call, please.
Carlicia Williams-Bradley.
Here.
Kurt Bollenbach.
Oh, excuse me, just one moment. 2 minutes, we are not ready to start. All right. Welcome, and it is good to see everyone at our state board meeting. Today is August the 27th. This is a special board meeting because it is on a virtual platform. At this time, I ask our secretary, Ms. Cheadle, please call the roll.
Alicia Williams Bradley.
Here.
Kurt Bollenbach.
Here.
Bill Flanagan.
Here.
Estella Hernandez.
Here.
Jennifer Moniz.
Here.
Brian Bobeck.
Here.
Superintendent Hofmeister.
Here. All right, thank you. And we do have a quorum. And we also, I will ask, did we comply with the Open Meetings Act?
Yes, we did.
All right, very good. All right. So board members, first, it is great to see all of you again. And I appreciate the service and work that you are doing today. And I want to start today's meeting by introducing you to two outstanding students. Sukanya Bhattacharya and Nicholas Sayegh are joining us today because they have been named U.S. Presidential Scholars. They are among 161 U.S. Presidential Scholars chosen this year out of 3.6 million graduating high school seniors in the nation. The White House Commission on Presidential Scholars selected students every year based on their academic success, artistic and technical excellence, essays, school evaluations, and transcripts, as well as evidence of community service and leadership that's demonstrated with high commitment and high ideals. So now I'd like to tell you a little more about each of these students. All right, so first, Sukanya graduated this past school year from Heritage Hall in Oklahoma City. When she was younger, she was a competitive gymnast and learned the importance of challenging herself and leading a team. In high school, multiple injuries shifted her focus to helping others. Sukanya founded and led her school's tutoring club. She also served as treasurer of the Children's Hospital Foundation Teen Board and volunteered at the Regional Food Bank. As president of her school's model United Nations, Sukanya learned to improve health through public policy, and she won the Harvard Model United Nations Social Impact Contest 3 times. Sukanya also conducted research at OU Health Sciences Center, and she is a co-author of a USDA-funded intervention to improve the nutrition and physical activity practices of kids in low-income family daycares. Sukanya will be attending Dartmouth in the fall. Sukanya, I wanted to give you a moment to speak to the board members, please. And welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you all inviting me to this wonderful meeting. It's certainly an honor to be selected as a presidential scholar, so I couldn't be more excited.
Oh, thank you. And board members, do you have any questions of Sukanya? I do. I would like to know if you have, as you think about your pathway forward, what are some of the plans that you would like to achieve with the education that you're seeking?
Yes, great question. So kind of as you had mentioned, I had done research at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. So I'm really hoping that I can use my Dartmouth education, which I will be starting in a few weeks, to leverage that as sort of a public health initiative. And of course, with kind of COVID going on, I'm definitely considering things like epidemiology that are becoming very, very important for us right now.
That is wonderful. And we know that no matter where you go in the future, you are going to bring a high level of standard of commitment and excellence. And we are just incredibly proud of you and the way you represent Oklahoma as well. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I also want to introduce to you Nick. Nick graduated from Western Heights High School as the class of 2020 valedictorian. He also finished this past school year with an Associate of Applied Science from OSU OKC. Nick has a heart for serving others as well. He founded the Western Heights K-Closet Initiative, which established food pantries and taught students about food insecurity in Oklahoma. For the past year, Nick has served as the teen board coordinator at the Oklahoma Hall of Fame. He is an Oklahoma Academic All-State member and has won more than 20 awards and scholarships, including the Oklahoma Music Educators Association All-State Percussionist and the Oklahoma State Superintendent Arts Award. In addition, Nick was also named an Oklahoma City University Minders Business Fellow and an Oklahoma City University American Indian Scholar. He will be attending Oklahoma City University as a double major in marketing and finance. And on a personal note, I am happy to add that Nick has been a valued member of my student advisory council. Nick, would you have a moment that you could also address the board at this time?
Yes, thank you, Superintendent Hoffmeister. I'm just super excited to be able to be honored by the Oklahoma State Department of Education, as I think education is one of my highest passions, and this is just truly an honor to be representing Oklahoma on a national scale as a presidential scholar. And I'm super excited to see what the future has for us.
And what about your thoughts about the future? You're looking at a double major. What are your future pursuits then with once you have those degrees?
Yeah, so I'm kind of crossed between the for-profit and nonprofit industry, because right now I work in the nonprofit industry and I really enjoy giving back to my community through nonprofits. And I think Oklahoma has a great market for it because I want to stay here probably the rest of my life. But aside from that, I would like to utilize the power that you get from the for-profit industry as a business executive and then in turn give back to my community through philanthropy and other means.
That's fantastic. Board members, any other question of both of our U.S. presidential scholars or comments?
I don't have a question, but I do have comments just to say I am so proud of both of you, Sukana and Nicholas. Thank you for representing our state and doing all of the amazing things that you've accomplished at such a young age. Continue to dream big, and I know that the sky is the limit.
I would do what Carlicia said and just tell you, we are very proud of you, and I know your families are too, and we're just wishing you the very best. I know you'll both be very successful.
All right. Well, thank you again, and we are excited to see what you do next as you represent your families, your school, your local community, but also the state of Oklahoma. So thank you so very much for joining us today. All right. Well, board members, we are also excited to share with you that Lori Gray is the Human Resource Specialist here at the State Department of Education. And Lori started with us in 2006 in the Office of Lifelong Learning and the GED program. In 2014, she was promoted to Administrative Assistant 3 in the Office of Human Resources. Later that year, she was promoted to Human Resource Specialist, where her focus is time and labor practices for the agency. Her nominator said, "I am sure that everyone agrees that Lori is a hard worker. However, it is her kindness and willingness to go above and beyond that I would like to nominate her for. Over the past 6 months, I have asked Lori for help on numerous occasions. Every time I have reached out to her, she has quickly responded and has been very patient. Her positivity has been a bright spot for me at the organization." Now, Lori was unable to join us today, but we are sending her a big congratulations for her service as she is Employee of the Month. And I know all of you appreciate the chance to celebrate those who are working behind the scenes at the agency to do this very important work in service to schools and families. Speaking of service, I would like to now recognize one of our employees who has been in service for the state of Oklahoma for 30 years. Michelle Presley, Regional Coordinator for Sooner Start. Michelle began her state service at OSDE in August of 1990 as a Resource Coordinator for Sooner Start in Northeast Oklahoma. She also spent a year as a Child Development Specialist for the Oklahoma State Department of Health. In 1997, Michelle was promoted to her current position of Regional Coordinator for the Northeast Oklahoma area. Congratulations, Michelle. And I believe Michelle is on with us.
Yes.
You are, Michelle.
Hi.
And we are so grateful for your 30 years. You've seen a lot of changes, I'm
Thank
sure.
Thank you. Yeah. I've just really been honored to work with families and children with special needs and help provide them with the resources that their families need over the years. So it's been a great job.
All
Wonderful
right.
job.
Well, and we also know that many are not acquainted with Sooner Start. Could you just mention in about a sentence or two who you work with and the group of students that or young people that we work with in that program?
Okay. We work with children from birth to three up to their third birthday who have special needs. Those may be identified as an automatic qualifier, or we may need to do testing to qualify them for the program. And what they would receive is they all get a resource coordinator that helps them with resources, state resources and federal resources, anything like that, to help benefit their child. We also collaborate with the State Department of Health, and they provide, like, our physical therapies, our child development, occupational therapy, speech, you know, those types of services. So we work really closely with the health department. And we've transitioned to the public school prior to the age of three. So we do a lot of work with school districts and Head Start.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. And we are so grateful for your 3 decades of service to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very
much.
Very good.
Thank you again. Thank you again.
Thanks.
Board members, school is underway. And as it has started for many districts around the state, some in person, some virtual, and some as a hybrid. To say this year is unconventional and will pose challenges is truly an understatement. In making their plans, schools have had to keep flexibility at the forefront at all times, especially when there are significant numbers of students and staff quarantined at different times because of COVID-19. OSDE continues to support districts as they reopen by offering updates to return to learn frameworks as new information emerges. This month's update include what to do when a staff member or a student exhibit symptoms of COVID-19 or test positive for the virus. It includes guidelines on quarantining, how schools can assist in contact tracing, and recommendations for conducting the in-person classes in physical education and fine arts. So preparing for our school to open means that we are also equally committed to having an opportunity to close the digital divide. So late last month, we announced that 175 school districts were awarded 50,000 Verizon hotspots through a competitive grant. Districts must pay a nominal monthly service fee, which is deeply, deeply discounted, for each device for at least 6 months, and that can continue in the future. They are also assigned these hotspots to low-income families. OneNet, which is also being a partner in this, is providing at no cost to districts content filtering and technical support, and this is actually a $250,000 value. Some districts have received their hotspots, but others are very close to having that as well. We wish that everyone had them before now, but unfortunately due to some inventory delays, that hasn't happened. But we are hopeful that that is just days away from being resolved for everyone. We do expect a quick remedy for all of this, and we want to make sure that everyone who needs that hotspot gets one. And districts are actually also able to use their own CARES Act funds or other resources to actually tie in to this same new state rate that we've been able to secure and leverage, and they can continue to add hotspots for additional students and then also for teachers. All right, so I'm also pleased to note that Imagine Math is now available at no cost to public schools for the 2021 school year. Under House Bill 4153, $1 million was allocated to implement this program. Imagine Math is an online supplemental math platform. It works with a classroom teacher to adapt online instruction to the needs of each student. So students can also access live one-on-one support from certified math teachers in English or Spanish after school hours. The program, which is fully aligned to Oklahoma academic standards for mathematics, will be offered to fifth grade and eighth grade students. These grades serve as bridge years for students either transitioning to middle school or high school. Imagine Math supports these students during critical transitions. And we know that these particular grade years of fifth and eighth, those standards focus on the essential foundational skills needed for future coursework and real world applications of mathematics. More than 32,000 fifth and eighth graders have already signed up for Imagine Math so far, and it's just started. Board, as you also know, that by now you know that our Secretary of State, Michael Rogers, stepped down earlier this month in his role as the Governor's Secretary of Education. Governor Stitt has not yet named his successor, but I would like to thank Secretary Rogers for his excellent and professional and generous collaboration these last few years. And I appreciate his dedication to the school children of Oklahoma, and I wish him the best as he focuses on his role as Secretary of State. This is quite a time for us to meet. As we know, we are just in that transition where some of our schools have started and others are about to. So board members, at this time, would you please turn your focus to our first item of action, item of business, which is item 3A, discussion and possible action on the minutes of the July 23rd, 2020 special State Board of Education meeting. And I'll ask if there is a motion to approve.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
All right, Mr. Bollenbach, is there a second?
Second.
All right, Ms. Bradley. And any discussion or questions? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Mr. Flanagan?
We'll come back.
Okay.
Ms. Hernandez? Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Thank you. Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right. Thank you. That motion carries. And now I don't know if I have an update on this, but are we able to go forward with item 3B or?
No.
Okay. All right, we're going to keep moving. So now item 3C, update and discussion of possible action related to COVID-19 response and operations. So we have a number of things to share with you. And I will ask now for Carolyn or Phil or Brad, if Phil Bacharach, whoever is ready to begin this section.
Sure, I'll just jump in here. Board members, this item under 3C is intended to be a standing item, a reoccurring item, a monthly update as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Under this item this month, you will see some sub items. The first being the teacher and support personnel under COVID-19 testing plan. That comes by way of the governor's third amended executive order 20-20. And in paragraph 23 of that executive order is identified a optional teacher testing plan. And I should say it's teacher and support personnel that are identified in the executive order. And so with us this morning, I believe we have Adrian from the State Department of Health to give us a presentation, a brief presentation on that particular plan.
Thank you, Adrian, and welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the time this morning. I'll just quickly, I didn't really prepare any slides, but I will quickly just share a high-level overview of our plan for testing for teachers and staff across the state, and then I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have regarding that testing plan. As testing has continued to be available through our county health departments, that's not going to change, but one of the pieces that we really wanted to be mindful of in working through this plan was to ensure that the current testing capacity in our state was not going to be impacted by adding additional options for testing, potentially 90,000, I think a little more, once we add in all the available testing for teachers and staff across the state. The other piece that we really wanted to take into consideration was making it convenient for testing for, you know, teachers that want to be tested, that they wanted to make it where they can reach them easily and quickly and get to those locations. And then the other piece to that kind of final piece is that as we have offer ongoing testing throughout the state, throughout the rest of this pandemic timeframe, that as things become more available, as better testing becomes more available, maybe less invasive, faster response times, those types of equipment and processes and procedures and things like that that become more readily available, we want to make sure that we're flexible and fluid enough to change to having those methods used. The initial phase of our plan, we're looking at launching really kind of into late next week. We hope to have a very clear guide of where and when we will be with testing. We're looking at utilizing additional contracts to go out and do a PCR nasal swab, but at different locations. So we're looking at different districts, and because we're going to probably roll this out where we're almost in every district over the next three weeks, that will be made available. So we'll have a schedule of those days, of those locations for the additional testing, and where those will be for the teachers and staff. We're hoping to work through the state school districts across and make sure that everyone is notified of when and where we'll be. In those areas that kind of have larger school districts, we're going to try to be in those two times over the next 30 days for additional testing. And then any time in between those additional sites that we're offering for teachers and staff, they can also continue to go to our county health departments. Testing is down really across the state. We're not, you know, I think the demand has not been as great as it was originally. So we do have a lot of availability still through those county offices. There's not a very long wait time to get appointments. And so that is something that we'll encourage teachers and staff in between those additional testing times and dates. If they want to get tested, if they've been exposed, if they're showing symptoms, those are things that we want to look for, that they can have that offering all the time available to them. But we'll continue after this initial set of testing options that we'll be making those available. We'll continue to look at other strategies such as saliva testing. As that becomes more readily available and that process becomes very clear, we'll make sure that we offer those as it's a less invasive procedure and can be more convenient for them. And the other possibility that we're looking at is the rollout of antigen testing and possibly working to have those at schools located eventually, where, you know, school nurses and other staff can be trained to come in and use some of those collection kits and have those processed where they're rapid response times of 15 minutes to have your results. So we're definitely going to have a very fluid plan so that we can, you know, adapt to what the environment is. And then finally, I'll just mention that part of the plan is also to have rapid testing and response, kind of rapid response teams to go out for outbreaks. And we've kind of defined outbreaks for any school that might have three or more positive cases in a school as kind of defining that outbreak zone in a school and offering additional on-site testing to those facilities. So those are sort of the major components of kind of our plan is where it stands today. And like I said, we'll continue to try to make sure that we move forward with what is the best testing available, the least invasive, most convenient, you know, and getting those results quickly. All of those are very important as we try to stop and mitigate spread. But I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. And board members, do you have any comments or questions about this? Thank you, Adrian. This was very helpful.
I have a quick question, Adrian. Thank you for that presentation. Can you, I know you talked about rolling this out over the next kind of 3 weeks. Are there districts where you've done any kind of pilot testing of any of this? Has any of that happened yet, or is that, you know, kind of what's going to be happening over the next couple of weeks?
We've done a couple of pilots as far as our antibody testing strategy, but we really went back and said, you know, if we're going to do rapid diagnostic testing, we really need to be doing PCR testing. So right now what we've been doing is looking at working with the State Department of Education staff to identify which areas have the most teachers, the most staff, and looking at that in comparison to our alert map and trying to identify areas with higher numbers so that we could have those sort of as our starting point. And we also looked at the different schools that were not in-person teaching as those might be a lower priority. I kind of smile when I say priority because we're going to try to do every district in 3 weeks. And so I think that all of them are priority, and we're trying to get as many as we can do, kind of a mobile site type of clinic, and working with the school districts and through our county health department teams to get that testing out. But yeah, so we haven't actually targeted any specific schools outside of our antibody strategy pilot project with the PCR. And so we're definitely looking forward. We have done some different similar organizational testing. So when we've had some testing outbreaks, we've gone into some businesses that are quite large. And so we have the ability to model that procedure and process for teacher testing at a pretty high number that we can do in a very short amount of time.
I understand that saliva testing is, the results are within 15 minutes. Do we have a ballpark idea of when that's going to be available significantly in the state of Oklahoma?
Yes. So we actually have received word that OSU has received kind of their EUA working in partnership with Rutgers. So they are working toward shifting their lab to focus on saliva over the traditional PCR swab testing. And so they're hoping that September 8th, they'll be able to start accepting those saliva test kits and start processing. And then that will help us know how many they can process at one time and turn that 15 minutes around really quickly. So one of the issues, we do have rapid 15-minute tests on the PCR swabs currently available, but those machines that process those take 15 to 20 minutes to run each individual specimen. And so it's hard to do large quantities when we're looking at that. And we believe the saliva is going to be a lot different because you can run a lot more at one time per machine. And so we're very excited that we believe OSU is going to be making that available in the coming weeks, that we'll be able to do that in our state.
And these are great questions. I think it's important for those board members as well as those who are also watching this. Can you define the PCR for us? I know it is the gold standard of testing, but maybe help board members distinguish.
Sure. And so PCR is just running the different diagnostic level. And so it's what we're using for kind of that gold standard is a nasal swab. And we do have some that are throat swab. We will tell you that our nurses and the level of invasiveness, people are preferring the PCR nasal swab to run that diagnostic test. And it really is depending on where you're going to find the presence of that virus. And so being able to find it early is going to be more often found using the PCR swab.
Okay, that's very good. All right, and we are surveying our teachers through membership organizations. So we will have more of an idea of the level of interest of teachers and school personnel. And then I know that information is going to be given to the State Department of Health, which will help them in their planning of making this available to all of those based on the executive order. And we know this is an important tool. So. Any other questions before we move on from here? All right. Well, thank you. And maybe we will have an update if you are amenable to that in the future after we get things running for a few months. So appreciate very much all of the work. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Very good. And then board members, I want to also give you an update. We will continue to give you data reports that will keep you up to date on the health and public health notices, those kinds of conditions that are occurring in Oklahoma communities, in counties, as well as in schools, which is part of the purpose of this particular item on the agenda. As a report back to you, and I was able to speak or communicate with each one of you before my visit with Dr. Deborah Birks, who is a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, and her visit on August 16th. And wanted you to know that she really did put a lot of focus on schools and the reopening of schools as part of her message to those who were in this group of various leaders at the state, municipal, and even school level. She started by saying that she is asking people to change their behavior to protect others. And certainly this has been the topic of conversation around those three W's: wear a mask, watch your distance, and wash your hands. And we are implementing that, as you will get a report here very soon, in our school communities as well. So as she cautioned Oklahomans, she did say that she was very concerned that Oklahoma was about 4 or 6 weeks behind what the South is experiencing, and that she wants us to take action immediately so that we don't experience what many of the Southern states are experiencing at that time of her visit, which was an increase in spread around the state. And she also did speak to the use of masks, both in the meeting and talked about how effective it is in actually dropping the positive results and the positive test, the positive daily rate, as well as just that community spread and overall numbers, and that there's a marked way of identifying every time you see that drop beginning two weeks after a mayor or a governor has implemented any kind of mask requirement. So she was encouraging those that were doing that work to really, really bring awareness to the effectiveness of mask wearing, both in the one who is wearing that mask, but also all of those others who are around them. Let's see. She also mentioned that we are we should be communicating as schools and as officials within the school community to families about their responsibilities. That really what is happening in schools, and we've begun to see this in schools with outbreaks that have occurred, it's really a reflection of what's already happening in the community, and that it's really important if we want to be able to open schools and keep those schools open, that all of the community do their part by those three W's again: wearing masks, watching your distance, and washing your hands. And that we can't drop our guard. She underscored that the coronavirus is with us even on the weekends, when we go to church, she said, when we are with our families. And it's too often that people forget that their families do pass the virus between one another, and parents to students, and then students bring that to school and also spread that among the school community. And the danger is that we have more of a densely populated condition in a school setting. So we see explosions of that that can result in a lot of people being impacted and quarantined. So this is the challenge. And she closed her remarks in the group by saying that that schools must be part of the public health response. So we will be able to share very soon what schools are doing to respond to that. And then I want to underscore what, in a side conversation after the meeting was over, what Dr. Birks did say. When I asked her, should our students and staff be wearing masks in schools? And she said, yes, absolutely. Students, all students and staff should be wearing masks at a minimum. And then she said, except for those in level green, in those green level counties where that transmission rate is below 1.2 people out of 100,000. And that is what we are continuing to send that message. Green is the goal. We can make a difference when everyone does their part. So it was really a reaffirming of what we know. It's going to work if we'll all do this. And then I also know that there was a report, which we will continue to provide for you. The State Department of Health posted just, I believe, yesterday, or the latest White House Coronavirus Task Force for Oklahoma. And we have included that in your packet. It does address schools as well. So you have that information, and we'll share a little bit more about that when I believe Carolyn is going to present. But I am very pleased that she did come, that we were able to hear from her and stay on top of the situation as we work very, very closely with the State Health Department and all of the local county health departments as well. It's really been a unique partnership. And I just even this morning was on the phone with the state interim epidemiologist who wanted to call and visit about a particular situation in a particular county. So this work goes on, and that's my update for you on this matter. If you have any questions or comments, I'm happy to entertain that. If not, we'll go on. All right, Carolyn, I will pitch to you, and let's talk about what we're seeing.
Thank you, Superintendent, and I'm going to share my screen. We have a couple of slides for you all board members to see. One moment. Okay, so it's good to see you all, board members, and I'm happy to be here to provide to you some additional information of things that we have learned and things that have happened for our schools over the last couple of weeks since our last board meeting. So as you all, I'm sure, are aware, we released the Return to Learn framework for school reopening. You can see the beautiful cover here, which is on our website. It was first released in early July, and then we recently updated it again earlier this month. It includes guidance from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and reflects the latest and best science-driven guidance. As you know, information on COVID-19 has continued to evolve, and we continue to try to update our guidance documents to ensure that schools are receiving the best information and most up-to-date information possible. Also, recently, we had the pleasure of joining Governor Stitt in distributing PPE, or personal protective equipment, to districts. Governor Stitt generously used $10 million of the state's COVID-19 relief funds to purchase much-needed PPE for Oklahoma public and private schools. The Office of Emergency Management stepped in to handle the distribution for that PPE, and that began August 14th. Among the items that were distributed were 1.7 million washable cloth masks. That is enough for two for every teacher, staff member, and student in the state. 42,000 clear face shields. That amount was determined based on high-risk positions in schools, like maybe perhaps your janitor or a special education teacher, and then additionally face shields for our pre-K through third grade teachers. The PPE purchase also included 1.2 million pairs of disposable gloves and 1.2 million disposable gowns. So those gloves and gowns were determined based on an amount that would be necessary to make it through the end of this first semester. We are very grateful to the partnership that we had with the governor and emergency management to distribute these items quickly and efficiently, and we know that schools are very appreciative. Additionally, we would like to share that, and you may, of course, already be aware, but the Oklahoma State Department of Health released a public health advisory on August 13th. The arrival for PPE for school districts has been particularly helpful in light of the contents of this public health advisory. It includes many recommendations for COVID-19 safety protocols from the Oklahoma Interim Commissioner of Health, Lance Fry. But the parts that are particularly relevant for school populations include what you see here on the screen. If a district is in a red or an orange county under Oklahoma's COVID-19 alert system, it is recommended, and actually this is for all counties, not specific to school districts, excuse me. In those counties, it is recommended that individuals age 11 and older wear a face covering over their nose and mouth when inside a business, a public building, or other indoor place that is open to the public. And of course, this very likely would include school buildings. The public health advisory also included the following recommendation: that all school teachers and other essential school personnel wear a face covering over the nose and mouth. Additionally, it is worth noting that the most recent report by the White House Coronavirus Task Force that the superintendent mentioned, which was released yesterday, indicates that Oklahoma has the nation's 12th highest rate for COVID-19 cases and is eighth in the nation for test positivity rates. So this public health advisory is very important to try to begin to slow that spread even further.
Before you go on, I just want to underscore, because I know you're going to talk about this in a minute, but I hope that all of those school board members are paying attention to this health advisory, this public health advisory by the Oklahoma State Department of Health. This is something that must be monitored, and it is in very capable hands by Interim Commissioner Lance Fry and his team. And we take his and those public health advisories very seriously. So there are some school districts that you will soon see that are not offering this kind of protection, and really think that we need to draw this to their attention, that this is something that the State Department of Health is recommending.
Certainly.
superintendent.
So as schools return for the new school year, we are seeing a diversity of plans from districts. The vast majority are offering some fashion of in-person instruction, whether that be full-time or rotating schedules or a hybrid of in-person or virtual instruction. A number of districts have adopted the Oklahoma School Safety Protocols or some version of those protocols that this board recommended last month, and we are pleased to see that. Okay. We recently, the State Department of Education, conducted an informal survey of our school districts, seeking to provide additional information about what is happening in our districts across the state for both our board members and for the public. On this slide, you can see that we did ask districts if they were going to have a mask requirement of some sort. And 65% of districts reported that they have adopted face mask requirements, either for staff or for students, and either in part or in full. So this nearly 65% represent districts that for some portion of their school population are requiring masks to be worn in the school, which leaves 35% that have not yet adopted any sort of mask requirement. And particularly for those districts that are in counties that are not green and have not adopted such a requirement, certainly we would urge them to consider doing so at some level. So at this time, I am going to pause for any questions from the board members before we go on to our next item. And I'll be back to have additional information to share here shortly.
I do have a question, and I know you made this available to a breakdown of all the districts and what they're doing, and I hate to spring this on you if you don't have this, but what is the percentage or the number of districts that do have both their students and their staff wearing masks? I'm just curious.
Superintendent, I'm not sure that we asked that specific question in the survey, but certainly I think it will be worthwhile to continue to survey them informally to try to learn more what they're doing.
Okay, and we did ask for really rapid information by our regional accreditation officers who then went and communicated with every single district with that, do you have or do you not have, a type of question. So we would be very interested in learning a little bit more, because I know that there is a difference. And that is something that is part of the conversation when communities are in consultation related to an outbreak with the epidemiologists. And I'm very eager to know a little bit more about that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from the board members at this time? Okay, so I'm going to pause here and invite Andrea Castaneda from Tulsa Public Schools to share the district's return to school plan. TPS had reached out to us several weeks ago and asked that they be allowed to share with you board members what they are doing. So we will pause to hear from them, and then afterward, I'll finish up with a brief overview of what districts are doing across the state when it comes to instruction. Andrea?
Thank you. Good morning, State Superintendent and members of the board. I'm so happy to be with you. If you give me one quick moment, I'm going to connect to screen sharing privileges so that I can tell you a little bit about our plan. And as I do that, I just want to start by, first of all, offering an extremely sincere expression of gratitude to the board, but especially to the OSD team, because truly, you all have been exceptional in your service to school districts over this period. We have weekly calls with you that are clear and they are honest, and they tell us exactly what we need to know. And sometimes the answer is we don't know yet, but in the district world, we know how that feels too. And so just I really want to thank you for your help. And I also just want to thank in particular those of you who have been exceptionally accessible I have texted Brad Clark at truly impolite hours, and I every week I tell myself that I will stop doing that. So maybe this is the week that I really will. But your responsiveness is part of what enables us to in turn be responsive to schools. So thank you for that. I also just want to say that although we are here talking about Tulsa Public Schools, I actually am kind of humbly presenting the work, I think, of school districts across Oklahoma. What we've done is not radically different. There is incredibly hard work and deep thought and dedication throughout the districts in our state. And so what you see from us is in some ways our work, but I also just think that in many ways, it's a district view into the kinds of things that are happening right now. So let me just quickly, okay, can I test and make sure you guys can see the presentation? Is that working?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. In following our own internal process, but also in meeting the emergency rules that you all set forth for districts, our board approved a distance learning plan. Tulsa Public Schools will be opening for 9 weeks of distance learning while we assess conditions, and this plan focuses mostly on how we are going to pursue the distance learning portion. If we're able to change into another mode because the safety conditions improve, then we will look forward to doing that. So there, I'm going to go quickly because honestly, I know that you guys are busy and all of the details are probably not what you're here to learn about, but there are five topics that I'd like to cover today. We're going to talk just briefly about the kind of engagement that we and many districts across the state have done. We're going to do a very, very high level view of distance learning, how we're handling attendance, our approach to policy flexibility, and recognition that we're going to be in partnership with you, the state board, on that. And then just talking about a few challenges that we see coming right away. One of the things that I think that we've learned even in an even more poignant way over the last, I believe I was told it was 176 days since the first COVID positive case in Oklahoma, is that we have ways to reach our community, and it has never been more important that we do so. So without belaboring the content on this slide, I think I'll just tell you a very brief story, which is that we have learned that we can run just like you're doing here, Facebook Zoom sessions, we can run live stream sessions, and we can live poll thousands of people in a single night. And that actually has been a huge step forward for us because throughout the summer, we've been doing this nearly weekly, and it has enabled us to get formative feedback about ideas and improve those ideas at the same time that we're sharing information about the emerging conditions of our schools and our community and the direction of our plan. So just a huge amount of engagement work and a huge amount of gratitude to every single person who has joined a session, who has offered advice, who has sent an email and helped us see the path forward. Here, this kind of takes us to topic two, and I'm going to give you only the kind of high level view of distance learning, and then at the end of this section, I'll pause to see if you have any questions for not just Tulsa, but for, I think, pretty much every school in Oklahoma. The spring did feel like a crisis response. We didn't have time to plan. And so we have been pretty relentlessly focused all summer on how to ensure that our opening of school, which is in 4 days, the 31st, does not feel like the spring, not to our students, not to their parents, not to our educators, and not to our building leaders. And that means that we've had to find this thick black line that distinguishes crisis response from intentional distance learning. And so our buildings will be open. We are encouraging teachers to make use of those buildings in a safe way during the school year, because that's where we have all of our learning resources. That's where they have access to reliable Wi-Fi and the technology they need to deliver in a digital environment. And then another, I think, important thing that I just want to call out for you all is that we, like other Oklahoma districts, had to suspend daily attendance requirements in the spring. There just were not the conditions to maintain attendance as we previously knew it. And there's a big shift coming this year. Our students have to be in school, and maybe in doesn't mean physically in the building, but it means every day school is happening and they're showing up for learning. We spent the summer, as did I think virtually every school district in Oklahoma, procuring high quality digital resources that round out our core curriculum and provide a complement so that if we're in distance mode, students have access to everything they need through a single landing page, and that's what you see here. If we are able to transition back into a hybrid or an in-person mode, they'll continue using those same resources seamlessly. There will not be an interruption between the two sources through which students access content or engage in instruction. So we're looking to minimize all of those transition points for students and families. And then trying to remove the barriers to access that we discovered were serious issues for students and families. And one of them, which you see here, it's this little mocked up badge, is that all students have personalized QR codes so that they open their device, they put their QR code under their camera, it automatically logs them into all the applications they need. No more remembering passwords, no more trying to remember the website that you need to go to. And as a brief anecdote to give you a sense of some of the things that it takes in Tulsa, but throughout Oklahoma to pull this off, these QR codes, we have 35,000 of them, and we laminated them and we cut them. And after we cut them, they were no longer alphabetized. So last weekend, Tulsa Public Schools staff alphabetized 35,000 QR codes for students, because we know that by the time our schools are distributing things, devices and paperwork and instructional supplies, they need to be able to just greet families and not be distracted by trying to figure out where those badges are. And then a final big piece I'm gonna hit just on distance learning is device and internet accessibility. I know this has been at the top of your minds as a board, on the top of our minds as a district. And this remains a serious, it remains a serious challenge for us. We have done, I do believe, what we could have and what we knew how to do. And so the first thing we did was we designated 2 weeks this summer and we called 20,000 families. And we didn't reach everyone. We reached about 75% of our 20,000 families. And we asked them, what happened with distance learning last year? Do you have a working device? Do you have internet access at your home? Does every student in your home have what they need to learn? And we've been able to use that to map back to the device distribution and hotspot pickups. We certainly want to thank you all for the 10,000 hotspots that we received from you. Without that support, we would not be able to deliver on an equitable version of accessibility. It was, I would say, instrumental work on your part and on the wide variety of actors making decisions about prioritizing Limited CARES Act funding. So thank you for that. And then step three is what we are doing now. This is one little example of every school in Tulsa has issued to families this device pickup schedule. And you actually happen to be looking at my daughters. So I know that on Monday morning, I've got two blocks and I'm gonna be going there with her. I'm gonna be getting her device. I'm gonna be getting all of the instructional materials that she needs from her school that need to be collected in hard copy, free and reduced lunch forms, all of the things that are gonna be necessary for her to be a successful learner from home. And by way of very brief anecdote here, I'll say that just another way to kind of imagine how this is feeling in districts is now on top of everything else, we have tropical storms coming. And so the plan to do device distribution through a drive-through process with curbside pickup now has to be rethought a little bit, because it is possible that we cannot do these outdoors. So we have to do them safely indoors in the ways that I hope Carolyn and the whole safety team here would approve of. So with that, I'm going to pause and just see if you have any questions about distance learning before we move on to additional topics.
This is Bill Flanagan in Claremore. With all the demands nationwide on equipment, have you been able to acquire enough equipment to serve your needs of your student body to date?
No, I appreciate you asking that. We have 16,000 back-order devices. And our original plan was to have a fleet refresh that was ready so that we had a safe amount of devices that we're holding back for emergencies and for broken devices and to deal with repairs. And we no longer have that buffer. So when we start, you can see August 31st, a few schools started this week. What we're gonna actually have to do is start on triage on devices and make sure that we are prioritizing families who don't have one at home. If they have a working device, we may have to come back to them later with a TPS device when our 16,000 back-ordered devices come in and are ready to go out to schools. But we appreciate that question because it exemplifies the degree to which all of us are living in this very fragile delivery chain right now. And it doesn't take many disruptions in places that are very, very far from our control to have major disruptions in the lives of our students and our teachers.
Thanks.
Okay, so briefly, I'm just gonna touch on attendance partially because I think that many districts in Oklahoma are cracking this nut in their own ways, but probably similar. So we wanted to give you one viewpoint into a way to be thoughtful about attendance, be rigorous about its enforcement, and also be compliant with the expectations you all have for us. So we have set up a system through which students are required to complete 10 instructional activities a week. That completion data gets pulled through our system into our student information system and then gets transferred in turn to your collection systems. And a very honestly interesting and potentially powerful dimension of this is that it forces us to measure attendance not merely by, and honestly for us, not even by physical attendance or visibility, but whether or not students are completing work. And if we imagine an analog to this in classrooms, if I were a student that was physically there but did nothing, this would be the same as not getting credit for attendance. So in some ways, I do think that this can change the way that the student's experience plays out digitally and also the way that our teachers are interacting with and supporting physically present but disengaged learners. So there is a separation between how well students perform in a task that they complete and whether they do it at all. For us, attendance is merely, did you complete the activities? All students must do 10 per week. And then I also just want to be clear that we are really energetically communicating that we want students learning every day. We want them in school every day, participating in live sessions every chance they can, but we understand that the lives of our students and families may not conform to a bell-to-bell schedule. And so it is going to be possible in our distance learning model for students to not attend live sessions, but still complete 10 instructional activities because they'll be able to watch those live sessions taped through their dashboard. So I got an email from a parent 2 days ago who said, you know, we work days and we're available weekends to help our students. How can we watch lessons with our children so that we know what they're learning and we can support them? And the answer is that is fine. You do not have to be there for the live one, and you can log in anytime and watch those classes and get credit as an attendance activity. I will actually pause there and see if you have any questions about how we're proposing to handle attendance, recognizing that it is likely to go somewhat as we expect, but certain to not go exactly as we expect. Okay. I'm going to push on then out of respect for your time. Topic four, we've taken a package of waiver requests to our board for approval, which they have granted. And I think I'll summarize this mostly by saying that we're taking the position in Tulsa Public Schools that COVID is likely to lay waste to a certain extent to extremely thoughtful plans if those plans are not fundamentally flexible, because there are still things that have not yet happened to us that will change the way that we think about a student and a teacher experience. So the package of waivers that our board has already granted give us narrow and defined flexibility to make adjustments to our practice if we need them. And the reason that I put this language before you all is that we want to emphasize the degree to which that is not a carte, we did not seek, nor do we want carte blanche flexibility. We want narrow, time-limited flexibility to be used only when necessary and to the minimum degree necessary to be flexible during this year. It has been granted in a variety of areas that were important from our policy perspective, but I do just want to take this opportunity to elevate for you the reality that many of our policies are mirror policies to state policy. And so a board relaxation or contemplation of flexibility on our part does not mean we have full latitude to be flexible. And as conditions change across the state, Tulsa, but also probably other districts may be coming to you and saying, here's an area where we're seeing tension in what we believe is possible and what the law requires of us. And so not for action today, but more of a foreshadowing of some of the things that we think may possibly be coming. And I'll again pause there for any questions you have.
No, I want to just interject that I appreciate the opportunity to think in advance and to get the district perspective as we then have internal conversations and grapple with various issues we would need to consider both in federal and state law, and then bring some proposals or recommendation to the board at a future date. But it does really help to hear your perspective as you begin to think about the future months to come.
Thank you, Superintendent Hoffmeister. And kind of in perfect segue, I'll just conclude briefly by a little bit more foreshadowing. I think we would feel remiss if we didn't bring to you in this setting some of the things that we are seeing coming that are going to have real implications on our success as a system in serving our students under very difficult conditions, but also things that may in fact be playing out throughout the state and you've been hearing from your constituents about as well. First, I do just want to offer a very, very humble, in many ways, learned humility about the context. This plan that we've presented to you and to our board is long, and there's a lot of words and graphics in it, and it can create the appearance that we are ready. But what we actually are is as ready as we can be. And then I think we all just know that things are not gonna work the way we planned. They're not gonna, the first day may not go the way we planned. The first week won't go. Things will happen. Zoom went down internationally the other day when we had 6,000 educators on synchronous professional development. These things are going to keep happening, and our conviction to resolving them is undampened. But we do just want to recognize that this is going to be an up and down journey for Tulsa and many other districts. The second thing that I really want to make sure that we are abundantly clear about, although we know that you all alone cannot effectuate major changes here, is there is a very serious funding issue upon us. And there are many dimensions to that. They're all the dimensions that existed before, and even before COVID, districts were coming to the state level and saying, we do not have enough funding to operate. And now we are in a situation that is far more emergent and grave than we would have ever imagined even back in those days. So three, but not all, of the big drivers that we wish to call to your attention to. It costs us more to run a distance learning model or a blended model or simultaneous models than it does to run schools as normal. I believe it is almost an inescapable fact that because we do not have the efficiencies of scale, we're running multiple school systems at the same time. And that is more expensive. The CARES Act funding was enormously helpful. In fact, I would say that it was essential, but it actually doesn't keep our core expenses whole. What it does is help enormously on a one-time basis. These core expenses may persist for a while, and we don't yet have visibility at a federal or a state level into what needs to happen and what is likely to happen next as we continue to draw down on in some cases, our state and federal aid, and in other cases, perhaps even have to contemplate fund balance in order to continue to operate a skeletal version of schools in challenging environments like this. And then the third one, I'm sure you all have been hearing about it, but the USDA reimbursement rates do not cover expenses for grab-and-go meals. We have served almost 2 million meals in Tulsa Public Schools. It costs far more to package grab-and-go meals and serve them at a curbside than it does in a cafeteria line. And we are utterly committed to helping address the child hunger issues in our city. And it is not a self-sustaining program in the ways that it has been in the past. The larger the district, the larger the issue here. And then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask a quick question about that, if you don't mind?
Please.
On the cost to operate, you talk about that, you know, you lose scale. Can you give some examples of why you think it costs more to, you know, what are the additional costs to run the two, you know, kind of concurrent, I guess, systems, but I know for TPS specifically, for at least for the first 9 weeks, is the virtual system only. So can you talk about what the additional costs are there outside of, obviously, you know, additional costs of equipment?
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to clarify, you're talking about bullet number one, not the additional costs associated with child nutrition, correct?
That's correct. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
We're talking about that.
Yes, absolutely. So I'll give you a very brief example. Tulsa Public Schools, like many districts, has really had no choice but to create a virtual academy. So we have 5,500 students in our virtual academy. It has to be staffed independently, but we do not have enough teachers in our classrooms to release them without hiring more teachers to staff the academy. So what this means is that we've actually had to add almost three dozen additional teachers plus an administrative team to serve the same number of kids. There is no additional revenue for those additional teachers. And there is no way to scoop those teachers out of our existing schools because they don't have the staff there either. And this is what I mean by not having the economy of scale. You can be efficient in one model. It is very difficult to be equally efficient in both.
Are the on the virtual academy specifically, are those kids that are in a different program outside of the 9 week virtual, or you know, is that being run separately and differently than the rest of the virtual program?
It is, and this I get a thing I also think is common across many of our partner districts. For students and families who either prefer or have medical reasons to need 100% virtual sustained environment, even if conditions become safer and our schools go back, they will remain in a virtual academy by their own choice. So this is kind of the difference between as a parent being able to say, I prefer that my child goes back as soon as it is safe, or I prefer to know for sure that I have created the safety conditions for my child that feel comfortable for my family. And so parents opted into that. As I said, about 5,500 of ours have opted in. At the semester point, they'll be able to reassess, and then again at the end of the year.
And I would like to add, as far as the child nutrition reimbursement rates, that is something that will, that involves waivers that that we need during the school year that we're pursuing but have not been granted yet. We will continue to seek that, but we've been given a firm no.
Yes, thank you, Superintendent Hoffmeister. And to be even more clear about that, we understand that this issue is a federal issue, and the State Department has been enormously proactive in every opportunity that a waiver has been offered federally to speed its application on the ground in Oklahoma.
Also, though, just to make the board aware, and thank you for that, there is a difference in reimbursement in the summer than in the school year, and who can receive those meals. The need is staying the same, but we're transitioning into the start of school, and that presents a cascading effect in the some of these issues.
I've got one question about that, the additional cost. There are two types of initial cost. Number one is one-time cost and reoccurring cost. And so how much of that deficiency is single-time expenditures, example, the physical equipment to actually do the program, against reoccurring costs that would reoccur annually, time after time after time after time?
Yeah, thank you. It's a really important distinction from a district financial perspective. When we bring to you a statement like without supplemental funding, Oklahoma districts may find themselves in an additional funding crisis this year. At least we in Tulsa are thinking primarily of the reoccurring costs. So for example, the equipment necessary for distance learning and virtual academy, we have largely been able to cover that through the generosity of bond funding made available to us by Tulsans. But that itself is really one-time money. It's one-time money and one-time purpose. It does not relieve us from the reality that there are ongoing expenses that we must pay through state aid. And that number is going down while our expenses, our carrying costs for running a split model are going up. And I don't have the exact proportions for you. And I will also say that I don't think we know yet, because we haven't seen this year play out yet. What we've seen are the initial costs that we knew we had to budget for in order to responsibly make available to families the options that we have. And then the final issue that I just want to bring to your attention, although I know that it is not lost on anyone, any single member of the board, is the traditional districts, and in this I include brick and mortar charter school districts. We may be losing students very, very quickly to Epic. And when I say may, I say this in part to say that it's very difficult for us to know at this point in a year, because we don't have access to the information that enables us to be precise about this. On this point, I merely wish to say that for a system that is scaling as fast as they claim to be scaling, the benefit or the harm scales with it. And so if their outcomes are extraordinary and students are well served, then many, many more students are well served. If harm is being done to the systems that are working hard to continue to serve in a more traditional environment, or if harm is being done academically to the students who may be underserved in that system, it is happening on the same grade as their growth. And we will all know more about this collectively within the year, but merely on the challenge perspective, speaking on behalf of a mid-sized urban district and one of the larger in Oklahoma, not having visibility in to the pace of our enrollment loss and not having visibility in to the implications on funding and student outcomes that are being served through that system feels like a challenge and a risk that we would be remiss if we didn't take this opportunity to raise with you. With that, I'm happy to answer more questions, but I also promise to try to keep this in less than 15 minutes, and I am sure that I am slightly over my time.
Can I ask a quick question, Andrea, on EPIC? But two things. Do you have a sense yet? I mean, I know the count doesn't happen until October 1st, but of your enrolled population currently, kind of what it looks like in comparison to past years and what you're anticipating your attendance drop to be, even if not exactly specific? And then second, can you talk about, are you planning to, since you're talking about the virtual academy, since you have a fully virtual option that TPS is offering, I'm wondering if you have any plans to survey parents or to, as you get a better sense of that, why parents would be choosing to go to EPIC versus your fully virtual academy? Mm-hmm.
All right, so thank you for both of those questions. On the enrollment front, we are projecting an enrollment decline, but to exemplify how peculiar this moment is, it's actually still very difficult, no matter how many ways we segment our data, to get a real sense of what that decline will be. And I'll give you one example of why that's hard. Pre-K enrollment it's always tricky. And it's always late. But this year, pre-K enrollment is down, and we have a working hypothesis that families with pre-K students are saying to themselves, school isn't starting in person anyway, so I don't yet need to make a decision about whether or not to enroll. And that means that while we've always had a pre-K phenomenon of later August enrollments, we are seeing a brand new phenomenon that appears to be driven by distance learning and COVID. And so it's difficult for us to size that or to predict what's going to happen in the first few weeks of school or what's going to happen potentially even after we make our first possible mode shift into in-person instruction, which would not be earlier than November. So that's one example. Another example is that we have a number of families who have partially enrolled in our system, more than normal. And this might mean that a number of families are partially enrolling in different options in an attempt to figure out the best fit for them as close as possible to the start date. This is, again, it's not unique, but it is higher than normal. And it makes it very difficult for us to make accurate predictions about our final enrollment numbers. That obviously was a long way of saying I don't know, which I might have just said more briefly. And then on Virtual Academy, we are doing polling of satisfaction polling, not just in Virtual Academy, but of all of our families in the first 2 weeks of school. And we'll be working hard to understand how we can make their experience with us better.
Very good.
I don't want to take up if someone else has something, but I have a couple of other questions.
Yes, please.
One thing that I know kind of wasn't part of the presentation, but I wonder if you can address, because I think a lot of people probably have questions about it, as far as on the accountability side, can you talk about what TPS is doing to assess where students are coming in at, where their academic gaps may be, how you plan to kind of work to fill those gaps, and then kind of assess, knowing that none of us know how this school year is ultimately going to go and look,
how we will try to see if we're filling some of those gaps with the current services.
Thank you. First, one word of context is just a reminder of where at least Tulsa Public Schools finds ourselves. We were able to administer two rounds of MAP assessment last year, but we were not able to administer the third assessment. So that leaves us with a little bit of a data gap that makes this even more challenging. We are doing in-person pre-K screening throughout the system. That's important because we want to make sure that for our youngest learners, we have visibility into their likely needs. We are also going to be in the first few weeks of school, starting a round of thoughtful teacher-administered formative assessments to begin to better understand student need. We are anticipating, based on national data, that our least reached students will have lost approximately a year more learning than would have otherwise been the case because of the COVID-related interruptions. So if I'm a student who might otherwise have been predicted to be 2 years below grade level, we're anticipating that that student will now be approximately 3 years below grade level. And so the second part of your question, the first was about assessment, the second was about intervention, is as near as it can be our top priority, a focus on acceleration. And briefly, we reconstructed a school calendar to create intersessional periods where we can serve students who need more support. Wednesdays are also designated days where we're going to be doing targeted acceleration for students who need it. And we're honestly preparing for the likely need for a reconfiguration of how we traditionally think about summer school and have it focused on a system-wide approach to acceleration versus targeted acceleration and credit recovery.
Okay, thank you. I have one more unless anybody else has one. Sorry, I don't mean to monopolize it. Can you talk about, I heard you mention earlier kind of brick and mortar charters. Can you talk about equitable services as far as how TPS is working with not only brick and mortar charters, but private schools in your area as far as trying to ensure that all kids in your, kind of service area are receiving services that they need during this time?
Yes, I knew for sure that at some point I was going to get pushed to be out of my comfort zone. So your private school question is successful in making that prediction true. I'll say a little bit about the Tulsa authorized charter sector. We're continuing to partner closely with them. And so as we do so, we do our best to share information and share resources. And we also are honestly working hard to contemplate alignment of decision-making around modes to the degree that it makes sense for both of us. That helps ensure that there's continuity of experiences for our families, because we have many families that have a student in a charter school and a student in Tulsa Public School, a neighborhood school. And I have an enormous amount of confidence in the Tulsa authorized charter sector, because this issue of thoughtful, intentional, and equitable access is at the top of their mission statements, in addition to the top of their minds. On the private school equitable services, we have worked closely with the State Department of Education to make sure that we are in compliance with the recent federal rules and expectations around proportionate share and equitable services. And regardless of whether or not in the end we felt that was the right thing to do for students in the school system, we definitely knew that it was the only thing we could do with the funding that was being given to us. And so have partnered with all of the eligible schools to develop equitable service agreements. And in fact, as recently as Monday, those were traveling across the board for approval.
Thank you.
All right, board members, any other comments or questions? All right, thank you so very much for this. And we really, it is really helpful. And we appreciate you being with us today. Thank you again. And I will now transition to Carolyn to complete this item on the agenda.
Thank you, Superintendent. One moment. Okay, thank you, Andrea, for that presentation. And at this time, I think we'd like to give a broader picture to the board members for how instruction is happening across the state. Also in the survey that I mentioned earlier regarding the mask requirement, we also asked districts about how they are opening instruction for the fall. This information should not be interpreted to mean this is how districts will be conducting instruction for the remainder of the year, but simply how they are opening and beginning the year for instruction. Okay, so this first slide, it pertains to districts that have virtual options and are offering those as part of their reopening plan. So many of our districts have stood up full-time virtual programs over the summer and in preparation for the fall to provide an additional option for families that may not feel comfortable sending their child back to school in person, as you just heard was shared by Tulsa. So I failed to say this earlier, but this survey represents 536 districts. And of those, 69.6% of them are offering a full-time virtual option. So that means the family has chosen for that to begin the school or for the year or for the semester to go full-time virtual and does not intend to attend in person. An additional 7.5% are offering virtual only, so there is no in-person option. This would include our, I believe it's six statewide virtual charter schools and other districts that have chosen to start the school year completely virtual as Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and others are doing. Additionally, we have many districts that are offering in-person instruction. Reflected here in this chart, 75.5% of our districts are offering the option for students to attend fully in person. So these students would be attending only in person and would not have a virtual component that was a part of their plan. So these students are going every day for the full day. 75.5% of our districts have that as an option for our families. The remaining 24.5% do not offer a full in-person option. So that doesn't mean that they don't have any in-person instruction. For example, in this 24.5% would be districts like Edmond and Bixby that have chosen to do rotations or an AB schedule where students attend partially in person and partially online or virtually on those off days. So those type of districts are in the 24.5%. So again, I just want to emphasize that doesn't necessarily mean that those districts have no in-person option. It's just that they don't offer a full-time in-person option. Next, we asked districts about providing blended learning, and 44.4% of them reported that they're offering some sort of blended option. So blended is some combination of both in-person and virtual. And I feel compelled to say that the definition of blended learning, what that means for a district, is certainly in the eye of the beholder, so to speak. So I feel confident in saying that there are probably more districts offering some combination of blended and in-person learning. They just maybe don't refer to it that way. So maybe this slide to be taken with a grain of salt, or sand, whichever it is, but certainly here, I think this is information that we collected that we certainly wanted to share. So finally, over the next several months, we would like to highlight some of the innovative measures that various districts are implementing in light of the pandemic. Just as Tulsa had requested to present today, we hope to have additional districts back at each board meeting to share with you their plan, the things that are working well for them, the struggles that they're having, so that we can continue to learn how our schools are dealing with this pandemic across the state. So I want to highlight a few today that that reported things to us that we thought were particularly creative or innovative. Among those districts is Lawton Public Schools that started back to school on August 21st. And while most of the district's 13,000 students are attending in person, more than 5,000 are taking advantage of Lawton's virtual options, which are available for all grades. There is a dayside virtual, but also evening virtual classes that happen from 3 to 9 p.m. in the evening. And those have proven to be especially popular, as you might imagine, with parents of elementary school kids who are wanting to help support their students in that learning. Both the day program and the evening virtual program are taught by Lawton teachers. And the popularity of the virtual components certainly helps ensure that Lawton is able to have adequate social distancing. They are also requiring a face mask for teachers and students in grades 4 and up. Next, I'd like to highlight Bixby. Bixby is one of a number of districts throughout Oklahoma that have moved to an A-B rotation to reduce congestion in school buildings. Bixby actually began the year with something a little different than maybe some others who are doing an A-B rotation. Bixby broke their students into two cohorts. The first group of students came back Monday through Thursday through week one, and on Friday did virtual instruction. During that week, the other half of the students were doing virtual instruction for the entire week. For week two, this week, the second cohort is in class for the same schedule, Monday through Thursday, and tomorrow is set to do virtual learning. And then next week, the district will be fully virtual while they evaluate whether or not to go fully in person after Labor Day. So this approach has allowed for appropriate physical distancing on bus routes and reduced class sizes to 10 to 15 students in a room at a time, and has really enabled teachers to develop a rapport with students in case they do have to switch to virtual learning at some point completely. Bartlesville began the school year August 13th, but by then the district had already done much work in preparing for the year. Right after the July 4th holiday, Bartlesville administrators shared their return to learn plan with staff and to incorporate their input. And the district received feedback from the community in two large outdoor meetings that were actually held at the football stadium. And so, but by the time school began, Bartlesville families understood the plan. They understand that face coverings are required for all staff and students in fourth grade and above, and face masks are strongly encouraged for the youngest students. About 20% of Bartlesville students are enrolled in the district's full-time virtual option, and as in other places, that has helped to have appropriate social distancing in classrooms. Ida Bell Public Schools have been particularly diligent in ensuring safe practice on school buses. Masks are required on all buses and windows are kept open for good airflow. Student passengers also have assigned seating on their buses, and hand sanitizer is available in each bus. Moreover, each bus runs the same route twice to better accommodate social distancing. And while Ida Bell began the year with all virtual instruction, they returned to school buildings in the coming week. Lastly, Shawnee, like Bartlesville, Shawnee began the new school year August 13th with a comprehensive plan for common sense safety. Face masks are required for all staff and students. Hallways are marked to ensure one-way foot traffic on each side. Some middle school classes are using huge outdoor amphitheaters to ensure that fresh airflow suppresses the viral spread. And of course, hand sanitizers are available throughout the school, and hand washing breaks are the norm now. Many of the elementary school classes have even developed a game out of doing their hand washing. In addition, Shawnee families were given several options for instruction, including all in person, all virtual, and two hybrid models of in-person and virtual. The enhanced choices have certainly allowed them to have additional social distancing in their classroom. So there are some other tricks that Shawnee is using, and we have a picture that the district shared with us here. To strengthen social distancing, you can see in this photo, a number of the classes are using these nifty pop-ups on desk to keep respiratory droplets in their rightful places. And so we appreciate Shawnee for sharing that with us. And at this time, this concludes my presentation. Happy to take any questions or turn it back over to you, Superintendent.
All right, board members, any questions, comments on all this material?
I really appreciate the presentation. Oops. Go ahead, Estella.
No. I wanted to thank you for such a detailed presentation on what our schools are doing throughout the state. But I will have to respectfully step away from the meeting. So I didn't want to just step away without saying thank you all for the work that you're doing. And I'll be staying in contact. But excuse that I have to step away at this time.
Thank you.
Echoing the sentiments of gratitude for the presentation, I do have a question about some of the data that was presented originally when we were talking about mask mandates. Of the percentage of was no mandate, do you all know the breakdown of how many of those, of that 35%, are within counties that are not in the green?
We have not done that analysis, but that would certainly be possible. We do, of course, have it by district and know which county they reside in. And so certainly we could do that analysis and provide that to you.
And actually, I think the quick answer, I'm not sure, it would be easier just to identify if we have any green counties right now.
If I recall, Superintendent, there was one maybe on our last map released by the Health Department last Friday.
So we should be getting that updated. It'll post tomorrow, but we'll learn about that today. But it's likely, yes, that those are, it's very unlikely those are in green, I would say. But we'll get that information.
And I believe, as I think Brad said earlier, we do intend for this type of update to be a recurring item. So we can certainly bring additional information back to the board. And if there are things that you would like to see in such a presentation, we would certainly endeavor to include that in the future.
I'm hearing that Tillman, in the latest information that's was posted last Friday, is the only county in green. So I'm sure that Ryan Piper can look at that list and identify if any of those more than 35% are in that county. If not, then the answer would be none of them. They're all in yellow, orange, or red.
I've got a couple of questions that on the virtual school district, the education part of the programs, have we done any evaluation, or is there any national evaluation as to how effective they were last year? And two is, and how did that affect Oklahoma students? And how does that affect our standards as we move ahead? If we have everyone had less than satisfactory education last year. So, Carolyn?
For Superintendent, I'm happy to respond. Or Superintendent, would you like to kick off?
Sure. So the answer is absolutely. There is tremendous evidence that anytime you do not have the kind of instruction that we're putting out now, which is in the fall, with rigorous online tools and the kinds of platforms that are fully aligned with academic standards in Oklahoma, we really aren't expecting, I mean, we know that last spring was a kind of hold steady and hope to hold on and engage students, but there was not the kind of experience in that remote learning with a lot of paper packets, not having the connectivity that we've been able to address in a significant way. We still haven't closed the digital divide. We cannot rest. That has to happen. We still know that there is a lot more work to do, but we made a big dent in that over the summer. And then it is really important, though, you've highlighted two areas that I really want to also underscore. So first, just the difference. Online in the fall is radically different than what was experienced in the spring. And districts are communicating that, and families will experience that very, very soon. We've also made available to everyone the ExactPath tool, which can be used in the classroom, in person, and it shifts to online in math and reading English language arts for those students when they are in quarantine. A district may use that, and that's free to all districts since we used our ESSER funds at the State Department of Education to provide that for everyone. But then there are additional high quality tools that are learning platforms and then the content platforms that will be a part of the digital or the online experience for those schools this fall. And then second, to your other point about the gap, we know that the gap is really wide, and you heard Tulsa Public Schools describe that they know that their least engaged students, those who have the loss of that access with digital technology as well, are really, really set back. And that is something that has only deepened and widened. And we all, as a collective community in the nation, are working with researchers, looking at evidence, and you have to know where we are now to be able to identify that gap and close it. And instead of going back and reteaching third grade, let's say, the research is pointing to accelerating and working to try to compress this somehow in fourth. And so that's really the task at hand right now, not just for a subgroup of students that were behind, but for most all students. So it is a heavy lift, and it is going to be a setback. But the more we can support our schools by giving them access to a strong, robust, competitive education that's well-rounded, we'll be able to close that gap sooner. But then that's compounded by just the need for those resources. And districts are doing everything they can right now to address that. But until school starts and they start those early benchmark assessments, or they use the tool that is adapted in the way you answer questions with ExactPath that customizes that for each individual learner, we really don't know until we have that information back.
Thanks.
All right. Other thoughts or questions before we... All right. Well, at this time, we'll go ahead and take a 10-minute break. Some of our board members have requested just a personal break for about 10 minutes, and then we'll come right back. So, We will carry on with the rest of the agenda, which will begin with public comments. Thank you very much, and we'll take a break. All right, it looks like we are getting assembled and ready to come out from our break. Thank you, board members, for your attention and time already this morning. So without any further delay, let's go ahead and move to item number 4, which is our public comment. Do we have anyone for public comment?
We do not.
All right. And then that moves us to item number 5, which is the consent docket. Board members, you have that in front of you. Do you have any comments or questions, or is there a motion?
I would ask that we go through them section by section, as I know that I have a few questions about some of the applications, and or would ask that some of them potentially be pulled and get more information next month. So if we can start with 5A, abbreviated school day, is that an okay place to start?
Yes.
In regards, on the whole, as I've stated for a couple months, the quality of the applications are definitely going up. Clinton, in their abbreviated school day, they put the budgetary impact, the actual numbers of how they think this will impact their school. I think one or two others, maybe Stillwell, a few people put information in there. That is very, very helpful. The level of the quality of the applications are going up. The number of just conclusory statements that we often were getting have gone down, so I appreciate that. I would ask that we table Bristow. We need to understand what their 4-day program actually consists of a little bit better. So I'd ask that Bristow and also Noble and Sky to kind of have the same issue. I would need to know more of what their abbreviated school day looks like. And how they measure success on those. Does anyone else have questions or comments on 5A?
All right.
I'll second your, if that was in the form of a motion.
I'd make a motion that we approve 5A, but we table Bristow, Noble, and Skyfield.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any other comments or questions? And let's go ahead and take this action item separately. So I'll pause for any comment, question? Okay, hearing none, please call the roll, Ms. Cheadle.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, so that motion carries. Now, would you like to consider the cooperative agreements for alternative education programs?
On the cooperative agreements, this was just the first time I had seen this. Both Kiefer and Middleburg stated that they have no students currently in an alternative program. I think they were asking that they're able to retain those dollars set aside for that so that they can serve their students just within the normal classroom setting. I don't have a problem with that. My concern, though, is in the event that they end up with students in an alternative program, we've granted a waiver without ever actually seeing their alternative program. So I would just ask that if we approve it with the understanding that in the event that they have students that need to be in the alternative education program, that they you're in an alternative ed program, that they then come back to us and let us know what their alternative ed program looks like and also the reason for why they wouldn't co-op with someone else. Also, I would ask that I'm going to make a motion that we table Hobart's. They applied for a waiver for the co-op, but the information that was on the application really all surrounded abbreviated school days. So I don't think we actually have the appropriate information. So I would make a motion that we conditionally accept Kiefer and Middleburg with the understanding that if students go into the abbreviated school day program, that they come back and seek this waiver or give us additional information, and that we table Hobart pending receiving the appropriate information.
Second.
Okay, was that a second from Mr. Bobeck? No, yes, okay. All right, any discussion? All right, seeing none, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That passes. And also, just a comment that Ryan Piper, the Executive Director for the Regional Accreditation Officers, is with us if you do have a question about an application. All right. Item 5C, Library Media Services. And maybe D as well.
I was just going to say, I mean, I'd like to echo what Kurt said as far as, I think by and large, these are incredibly improved as far as giving additional information. I know, especially given the time with COVID going on, that this is something I think, I understand this is likely, not at the top of the list as far as things that are happening. I do think Hobart, Meeker and Antlers, those three stood out to me as not having as much information. I think we should go ahead and approve them, given that, there's a lot of other things to consider here, but just want to continue to emphasize with districts that, not necessarily in length, there are plenty of applications there that were very concise, but at least said what the plan was of how to make sure that the library was still accessible to all students at all times during the day. So just continue to encourage districts to provide detail in these applications as they come through. But I'll make a motion to approve 5C.
Second.
All right, that was a motion by Ms. Moniz. A second, was it by Mr. Bollenbach?
Yes.
Any other comment? Please call the roll. And this is for C and D. All right.
That's fine.
Or do you want to do, yes?
I'll amend the motion to say to approve 5C and D.
Second. Thank
you. All right. All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. Thank you. That motion carries. Next item.
May I make a comment, please, short? I just wanted to tell Ryan Piper, do a great job for his team as we, again, echoing what's been said already about these applications improving, and just encourage him to continue to ask his folks to, when they're talking to the districts, to ask them to put as much detail as they can. But he's done a great job.
Thank you for that, Mr. Bobeck. All right, item 5E, E as in Edward. This is related to the issuing of emergency provisional certificates.
Oh, wait, are we on textbooks or are we on emergency certificates?
We're on E, emergency cert.
Oh, sorry, that's not interesting. Let's see the number by that. I'll move to approve.
Second.
All right, is there any comment or questions? Okay, proper motion and second. Please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley.
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach.
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan.
Aye.
Ms. Moniz.
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck.
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister.
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. Next is approval for requested flexibility to use textbook funds.
I had a couple of questions in regards to the application, especially in regards to Colbert. It appears to me that they've already purchased computers using Title I money and textbook dollars, and I think they're now coming after the purchase has been made to us for an approval, and I just want to make sure that all of that is okay, that we are able to do that, and what should we do, because I just want to make sure that we can have funds that we're obligated, but needed a waiver, that we're able to make a waiver after the obligation has already been set, if that makes sense. I've done my, I believe it was OP SRC finance class, and I know just enough to be dangerous. So I was hoping the mayor might be able to help us out on this one.
I can jump in, and I think Monty Guthrie is on with this as well, as it that involves federal programs to an extent, it sounds like. The textbook fund, the definition of textbooks, I should say, includes the authority to use those funds for technology. And so in my mind, there's not a question on that aspect. With the federal programs, it's on a reimbursement basis. And so it's an after the process claim based reimbursement. But Monty, I see you're on. Can you jump in with any additional information there, please?
No, Brad, I think you're right on. And this spring, with the addition of the CARES funds, there were, and the fact that the federal programs do run on reimbursement, everyone was trying to work their budget to finish out the year the best they could, and having not seen everything behind this, that's where I would lean to think they were going.
Thank you.
So there's no, I just want to make sure there's no problem with using textbook funds to buy computers.
Oh yeah, no.
Okay.
All right.
Can I ask a question? Sorry. To that end, why are they having to ask for a waiver?
So the statute requires that the textbook funds, let me back up. I'm not even sure what the entirety of the request is for. I know part of it is for the ability to use these textbook funds that are allocated for textbook purposes, which includes technology or computers. But if you do receive that flexibility, if this board grants that, then the option becomes to use the funds for the support and maintenance of the school district. So I'm not aware of what the entirety of the request is for, but it would open it up if the waiver is granted.
My understanding is they're asking that they be allowed to use textbook funds to buy computers.
Is Ryan Piper on?
Yes, Superintendent, I'm here.
Do you have any insight?
Yes, ma'am. I'm looking at it currently and reading through it, that they are wishing to purchase computers, as previously stated, and updating their computer labs for testing purposes as well as other things, and that they did use some Title I funds, as previously stated, and that that appears to be the totality of this. This is a resubmission for what that information is worth that was previously tabled at a prior meeting.
Yeah, I mean, to come back to it, I think the short answer is if they are using the funds to acquire computers, I don't think the waiver is necessary.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand. If you're allowed to buy computers with textbook funds, I don't know why we have a waiver before us.
Perhaps is it about the maintenance of the computer lab to get it up to standard for assessment?
I mean, it says that they intend to purchase computers that will upgrade their lab. It has to do with some outdated technologies.
So could that be, instead of just the hardware, it's including the waiver would need to be for the upgrades in, I'm just guessing, I'm sorry.
No, Superintendent, board members, I am looking at it as well now. And it appears to be limited to computers.
Okay.
Ryan, jump in if you have additional information, but I'm not seeing anything further.
No, I do not. I believe that's correct.
All right. Then it sounds that that is not required.
Yeah, for that one district, I mean, we might communicate with the district, and if there's a more defined understanding beyond computers, then it could certainly be brought back. But
I would make a motion then to table the Colbert application and approve the Bixby application.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other questions? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, that motion carries. Next item, general fund for capital expenditures. Item 5G.
We've had a few of these. It always concerns me when I see classroom dollars being put into capital projects. If it's, I believe we had one last year for Bridge Creek Quarter. Enrollment was up. They needed two classrooms. That seems pretty obvious that it's being used for effectively classroom dollars. I do have some concerns about Bethany's, as I noticed. It looks like it's not for necessarily a specific project, but maybe that they may want to do things such as purchasing real estate, maybe fixing a parking lot. I also know that I saw in the news where they just passed a $7 million bond, I believe, this week. And some of the items that are on here seem duplicative with what was passed in the bond issue. So I don't really understand why this is before us.
We actually have the superintendent of Bethany, if you'd like to ask those questions.
Good morning, board members and Superintendent Hoffmeister. My name is Drew Eichelberger. I'm the superintendent of Bethany Schools. So the reason for this request, we've done this request for multiple years back before my taking over here in Bethany when Dr. Schellenberger was here. The reason is we have our building fund is very, we don't receive much money in our building fund. So the 5-year average for our building fund is $81,000, a little over $81,000. So it is difficult to, we have over $35 million worth of buildings in our district, and it's difficult to keep all those up with $81,000 worth of building funds. So we have in the past used general fund money to do that, to be able to help keep our buildings up into the shape that we need them to be.
Why is your building fund so low?
our building fund is set by the state funding formula. So, and I believe, and Brad could probably help me a little bit on this, I believe that is, there's a millage that each district has. It can only go up to five mills, and we're at the max of that, and we just have a low valuation. So our district, if you're familiar, is 1 square mile. Our valuation is $17 million total. You have to remember that the school district itself, that I just quoted you $35 million worth of buildings, they don't pay taxes, so that doesn't count. SNU across the street, all their buildings, that doesn't count. The Children's Center across the next street doesn't count. So none of the churches that are in our 1 square mile count. So we have a low valuation. The result is we have a very low building fund revenues.
That makes total sense. The way I was reading the application was that the goal was to, as opposed to, I mean, I do see where you said, hey, we need to maintain buildings, but I was reading it more as we're looking to expand by lockers, these types of things that I also am seeing in the bond issue. So I do understand where, based on kind of the geographic and the demographics, where your building fund is not really commensurate with your need.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of your consideration for this item. It, you know, we have an outstanding school district in Bethany, and part of that is the physical upkeep of the place. People don't want to go to a school that looks not well kept. So with your approval, we'll be able to continue this, and I thank you for your consideration.
Drew, I had a question. Just for closure on the bond issue that Kurt brought up, is there any insights you can give us? None of that money will be used for this purpose. Is that correct? Or was not intended for this? Is that
right? That's a great question. Bond issues have to be spent. 90% of the bond issue has to be spent on what you had on the voting ballot for that. So we've got a $7.1 million bond. We've got three projects, and those will be done in full. One of the issues that you have with that is we try to have a little bit of extra money in that bond for the increased amount of what the construction and the parts of the things that, you know,
materials.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Hoffmeister. So sometimes that gets ahead of you, but we end up having to use other money for that. And most districts would then, I came from Putnam City. We used building fund money to round that out if we ended up spending more or making change orders onto a bond. We think we have enough in it for this time, but we still have lots and lots of opportunities to get better around here.
We understand the need for, maintaining, which is far less costly than rebuilding.
That is correct. Thank you.
Based on that, I'd like to make a motion for approval.
Second.
Can I just real quick before that, just thank you for being here to answer questions. I know you're incredibly busy, so we really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I appreciate that. And we appreciate all that you guys are doing for us. We know you're working hard and taking time out of your lives to serve on this board for free. So thank you.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. Board members, please turn your attention to item number 6A, action item, which is discussion and possible action of payment of late federal program claims listed below. And we have Mr. Monty Guthrie, who is here to help present this information.
Hello, board members. It's very good to see you again, and Superintendent Hoffmeister. And it just seems really strange addressing you all while sitting down. So it's a little of adjustment. But anyway, last year when we started this, I spent a lot of time going through and trying to help everyone understand. It seems simple to have everything in on a certain date, but because of purchasing, procurement, shipping, all of those things, it can be very, very difficult. And of all of those challenges that I tried to describe to you last year, I would just say that they are all still in place, and they seem to have been on steroids since then, because with everything that's going on, last year I presented this, and you know, I told you all there may be a few more coming, but I thought we had the majority of them. I don't foresee that this year. There are so many things that are tied up in customs, backlogs in ordering, along with the fact that we added the CARES Act onto all the other federal programs. I really see this is going to be an ongoing thing that's really been a challenge. I will say that I work with both federal programs and child nutrition, and those two groups have just really overextended themselves to try to work with the districts and have put in a lot of great time. Also, to help with this, as well as some other things, I would love to give a shout out to the Data and Information Department at the State Department of Education. They've worked with all of the departments, and they have put together a calendar that's color-coded, and it can merge with your Google Calendar or other types of electronic calendars that you may use on your handheld device. And I think that it will be a tremendous asset to our administrators in the future, as opposed to a written document or making sure you didn't miss that one email that reminded you of a due date or something. You can just download it to your own personal calendar, and it has everything there. And so even in the midst of everything that's been going on at the State Department of Education, some people took it upon themselves to work together and put something together that would be a great benefit. And a lot of people, I mean, to be honest, you don't expect things like that to come out in a time like this, because everyone's doing so much just to serve the pressing needs. But the continued looking into the future and trying to make things better for our districts is something that I continue to be impressed with by the employees at the State Department of Education. So with that being said, pursuant to Oklahoma Administrative Code Rule 210-25-3-7, in parentheses 12, forms requesting reimbursement against any federal program section of the State Department of Education must be received or postmarked on or before August 1st. Silo, Ketchum, Bristow, Fanshawe, Poteau, White Rock, Adair, Santa Fe, South Latta, Fort Gibson, South Rock Creek, and Buffalo Valley have provided a good cause letter of explanation and are in payable form. We would just ask that the State Board approve this requested payment.
Mr. Guthrie, you did not mention POTO.
I'm sorry.
And I just wanted to make sure that you are making that same
reference. Yes, I am. I'm sorry. Just as listed.
And I want to also ask, just for my own edification, are the various issues related to technology and various shipments being held in customs, not being, or supply chain issues, are those impacting some of what you're describing, where they then cannot be timely with other reporting requirements?
There is no doubt that delays in manufacturing,
delays in shipping, things being held up in customs, all of those things. And the fact that, especially with CARES money, schools were trying to get the orders in place as soon as possible, which would, for many schools, that was June. And then when you put all of those things together, they were trying to get prepared and have everything they possibly could to plan for all the multiple scenarios that they're trying to prepare for this fall. They were trying to get everything in place, and just the, as I said, everything that you can possibly think of to make this thing a little more challenging, and trying to and you would be afraid to cancel an order and move that forward to the next fiscal year, because you would just move further down the list of receiving goods and shipments. So that's going to play a big part in the late federal claims, as well as many central offices taking on many more responsibilities through the summer than they typically would. I don't know of anyone in education right now that's not doing far more duties and jobs and responsibilities than they've ever had. And so when you start stretching that out and throw, especially in small schools, throw an illness, a maternity leave, things like that into the mix, it can really create some tough situations for our school districts.
All right. Board members, do you have any questions about these? Or is there a motion?
Move to approve.
Second.
All right. Ms. Cheadle, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. Item 6B, discussion of possible action on 2021 shared superintendent salary assistance applications.
Board members, you have in front of you a list of shared superintendent applications from 70OS7-203 from the State Board to review. These districts have entered into a mutual contract with the superintendent and are requesting 50% assistance of the salary or wages for not more than 3 years, and no district can receive more than $150,000 total. The funding for qualified application will be from the School Consolidation Assistance Fund, paid in 4 quarterly installments. Last year we had four districts that shared two superintendents. Keys and Optima ended up joining other districts. They did not come together as one, but they ended up joining other districts. The only other districts, the only other two districts that are asking for a second year of this would be Brushy and Moffitt. You can remember, I don't know if you remember or not, the Superintendent Reynolds last year as serving as a dual district superintendent had a flood to deal with. And this year he is dealing with the pandemic. So that's been a very challenging situation, but he continues to do a good job. Red Oak and Panola had tried a partnership with a statewide virtual school, and they have now decided that a shared superintendent, and also they've gone from K through 12 to K through 6, and they're going to partner with Red Oak and share a superintendent there. Albion is also a dependent school district, and they would like to partner with Whitesboro for a shared superintendent. And Strother and Bowlegs are also requesting assistance for a shared superintendent. And I did some checking, and you know, there's several instances historically that this has been a very good situation to bridge the gap, and schools have continued to work on their own, and there's others that schools have consolidated. So there's been several schools that it's been a great opportunity for them to manage through a very difficult time, and then also remain to be a very working entity within the education system.
Mr. Guthrie, I have a question. So one stood out to me. I understand understand the kind of premise behind wanting to have this, and based on, you know, kind of the research that you just discussed, there have been advantages to doing this, I think, for school districts that have been a benefit to both the district and the state. One, just in reviewing these, that stood out was the Strother-Bowlegs arrangement, which essentially, at least the way it looks to me, I mean, if I'm reading it correctly, would be paying that superintendent $161,000 a year, with the state picking up $80,000 of that. Just research that I did looking at Strother is 408 kids PK to 12. Bowlegs is 212 kids PK to 12, so 620 kids total for $161,000 superintendent that's being split half with the state. I guess the question, A, I have a concern about that, but then B, does that seem in line with districts that you've seen take advantage of this program? And do you have any additional information as to why that salary would be high as that is for that number of kids in a district? And is that out of line with superintendent pay in general across the state?
I would say that the superintendent pay is going to be a local decision, and I am not very familiar with those two schools. I will come out and say that, but there is a reason they capped it, that no school can receive more than $150,000 over a 3-year period. And I'm assuming that that's probably the reason for that cap.
Is one of the purposes of this program to encourage, it would seem to me that we're encouraging schools to bring together administrative functions, if we are simply though taking the what was appears to be the base salary of school number one and the base salary of school number two, adding them together and then having the state pick up half the tab, it feels like all we're doing is giving paying full freight for only half of a superintendent at two schools. And we haven't it doesn't appear to be saving the state as a whole any money. That one in particular did jump out to me. We're giving half of a superintendent to two schools, but I feel like we're still paying full price. Unless previously those jobs were both higher priced jobs.
I apologize, board members. I really do not have that information, but I can certainly research that and get it to you.
Well, one question I had too was, are there any requirements? So there's not any kind of description as to why they're sharing a superintendent, you know, why the split is between, you know, I mean, even on some of the other applications, some are splitting it kind of 60-40, some it's 80-20. Is there any requirement within asking for this for them to give any kind of description as to why they're sharing a superintendent, you know, why the breakdown is what it is, anything that's required for them to submit?
The breakdown seemed to – go ahead. I'm sorry, Brad. Go ahead.
Okay. There's not a requirement for a description of why they are entering into the mutual agreement to share services and the superintendent. There is a requirement that we obtain copies of the employment agreements for the superintendents, and that primarily serves the purpose of being able to verify the amounts identified for the salary. For example, I'm just going to give you the example of Albion that's on the agenda today. Recall board members last year, they were put on probation, in large part to financial situations there. And so if you see the reflection of of A, entering into the shared services agreement and to share the superintendent. I can only believe that is intended to reduce their expenditures. And in fact, that is reflected on their application anyway. So we do have the employment agreements. You can make some determinations from the applications as to maybe why those agreements are entered into. But as a standalone requirement, there's not that requirement for providing the description of the reasons for the agreement.
I'd like to make a motion to approve outside of the Strother Bolives, if it's within our ability, to ask them to potentially come back and better explain why they are moving into a shared superintendent agreement and kind of the explanation behind some of the financials. I would like to request that with those two districts.
Yeah, I did pull up a calculation sheet, and the superintendent is showing a $111,000 contract from Strother and $50,000 from Bowlegs. Is the breakdown on the salary.
I'll make a motion to approve the other two applications and to table the Strother Bowlegs application and ask them to come back at our next meeting or provide further data and information on kind of why they're entering into that agreement and why the salaries, you know, for each set were set at where they are.
And just for clarification, there were a total of four.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So I move to approve the other three and table the Strother Bowlegs.
I have a question before we go further. Does anyone know what, is there a requirement to have a superintendent in order to open a school district?
There is a requirement to have a superintendent in place.
Okay. So what will happen to one of these?
Potentially, there could be an appointment of an interim for a period of days. I believe it's 60 days. I can confirm that. I see Ryan and Monty are both on here. They might be able to confirm that period of days, but...
Are we voting to fund the shared superintendent or allow it? Because you can share administrative services that doesn't have anything to do with being reimbursed, is what I'm thinking.
And I didn't think of this a moment ago answering your question, superintendent, but I think it is possible, if not likely, that the arrangement continues. The application before us today is to access the funds in the school consolidation fund.
Yeah.
And so.
Okay. I see. Thank you. All right.
I've got one comment on this is that when you look at these smaller school districts, having a superintendent represents a large percentage of their expenditures that is non-classroom related. And the ability to control that and lessen the effect of that due to the number of students is what the purpose of this deal is. And for the state has made it an incentive that that we avoid this situation that required a certain level of expertise that is needed. So I think it's the purpose of the state was to reduce that cost to the smaller school districts and put this incentive in to make it all work in the long run.
So as opposed, it's more of a, is it fair to say then it's more of a budgetary incentive as opposed to a cost savings incentive?
Yes, I would say that. Because you don't have two people and two sets of benefits, and so it's a desire to see that collapsed into one. And what we have seen historically is when districts come together like this, often they do voluntary annexation and consolidate. So this was the purpose of the incentive fund. When there's a certain balance that has to remain in there until a certain point in the year, then it is distributed to districts. That is the purpose behind, I may have just misstated that. It's the technology fund that's distributed later. So Monty, you can correct me if I said that incorrectly.
You may have confused me, Superintendent. I'm sorry, I was looking through something.
Okay, no problem. I think that it's a lot of money. I will just tell you personally, I think that it's a lot of money for a superintendent over the number of students that we're talking about. And I think that that may be part of the thinking in the minds of some board members in objecting to this or having questions. So I'm trying to separate if that is something we are able to weigh in on, and it may very well be. And as Monty pointed out, they still have the local control to make their own decisions about how they spend those funds. But to the point here before us, it's whether or not the state approves this as a expense that comes with a defraying of that cost through this fund. Is that correct?
That is, I mean, for me, I think the question that I have in the piece, I mean, I totally get and agree with that local districts get to set their superintendent salary where they see fit. But what we are being asked is to allow $80,000 to be expended out of the fund. And I just have questions about the reasoning behind why that. And I get that there's a cap of $150,000, but they're using over half of that cap in 1 year. I think that I'd like to hear why before we allow that.
Superintendent, this is Carolyn. Would you like me to clarify the fund?
Yes. Please.
Board members, this fund is typically in our budget, the budget that is passed by the legislature. It comes from 5% of the lottery dollars that are set aside specifically for the purpose of supporting school consolidations and annexations. So you've seen come to you severance pay and cost with consolidation and annexation. That is one purpose. The other purpose is specifically for what you're considering today, which is the shared superintendent process or option incentive for districts. Those are the two primary purposes of the fund. The statute does say that if at a point in time the fund reaches more than $5 million, then the amount that is above $5 million is distributed out to districts for technology, which is what Superintendent was referring to earlier. So the base amount of the $5 million is specifically for the cost that you're considering today, in addition to any consolidations or annexations that would come before you during the fiscal year.
Thank you for that. I personally want to register, though, it's a lot of money for the duties of this number of students. That's my opinion. Okay, so what is the motion then for this, the group or of the listed applications?
The motion that I made was to approve the other three applications and to table the Strother Bowlegs and ask them for additional information, either in writing or for them to appear at the next board meeting to better clarify why they're asking for the money out of the fund.
Okay. Second. Okay, very good. Motion second. Any other comments or questions? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bullenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. Now, board members, I have an update for you from one of the questions that came up earlier about those 35% of the districts that are not in a, do not have any mask requirements in their school. That represents 190 districts. And of those districts, three of them are in Tillman County, which is the only green level county at the current time. So that, I hope that helps clarify what I think, Carlisha, you had asked for a little more detail. So of those, then 187 districts are in a county with elevated spread, yellow, orange, or red.
All right. Verification. I'm curious of in those moments of updates, is there, does it have to be on the agenda for our board to act upon the information that you're sharing? So you sharing that and stating that there's 190 districts, of those 190, only three are in a green zone and there are no mask requirements by their local boards, and us understanding the recommendations from the White House task force, also from several health professionals that have stated that those mask requirements are instrumental in ensuring that we slow the spread. How can our board potentially engage in discussion on any action to support with those guidelines being enforced, especially in those areas where local boards have not chosen to take that action?
Well, there have been examples of where we have asked people to come before the board or to respond to the board in some kind of written format. That would be one example, but yes, the board can make, if it's an action item, of course, ask for something. If I'm not sure exactly what you're
Is there ever a time for us to revisit a mask mandate statewide?
I think that there is, but that is something I would want to do with greater discussion between all the board members and respond to what we are seeing. And so I think that, yes, that is something that can be done. There could be another board meeting for that. But yes, that is a possibility in the future based on changing, you know, different data that comes before you.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
All right. I would like to know why those districts, if they will, maybe we could look at one of them, and I know we're going to be hearing from different districts. I would like to hear from someone in that group to understand why they haven't taken any steps like the majority of the districts. I think that the board was serious when they made those recommendations, and I would like to understand why. So perhaps I know we can hear from more districts in the future, and that would be something we could explore. All right. Okay, so now board members, I think the next thing for us is the legal presentation on item 7. So let's look at executive session. I'll ask legal counsel if you recommend executive session.
Yeah, Superintendent, board members, at this time it would be appropriate, and we do recommend convening an executive session to discuss the one item under that topic today.
All right. Is there a motion to go into executive session?
So moved.
Second.
All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, let's move into executive session. And board members, you have, I will ask for the instruction for board members.
Superintendent, board members, you should have a link to a separate meeting. So if you would jump off of this meeting and log into the other meeting for purposes of executive session at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. We are now moving into executive session. We appreciate your patience moving in. Thank you. And I would ask that you mute or and stop your video on this as we move out. All right. Thank you, Jeremy, for getting us set up and ready. All right, it looks like we have everyone with us. We'll wait for the screen to change. All right, very good. Thank you. We are coming out of executive session. Is there a motion to come out?
Make a motion that we return to regular session.
Second.
All right, motion by Mr. Flanagan, second by Ms. Bradley. Please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bullenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. We are coming out of executive session. For the record, we did have three members of the legal team, Ms. Murphy, Ms. McCullough, and Mr. Clark in executive session with members of the state board. Now, board members, is there any motion for you to consider on item 7A?
I'll move to revoke, suspend the teaching certificate on item 7.
All right, on Aaron Hernandez. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Mr. Moniz?
Aye.
Ms.
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, that motion carries. Now we will entertain an item to adjourn, a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
I missed who the made the motion. Was that Ms. Moniz?
Moniz and Bradley.
And okay, thank you. All right, now please call the roll.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right. Motion carries. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much for your time and service today.